Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. We're going regional today, aren't we, Beth?
We are. We absolutely are today. We're joined by Hugh Rees and Sian Kilcoyne, a brother and sister team of historians. They're very passionate about Welsh history. They run the Welsh History Facebook page, and they're here to talk to us about their first ever book on this day in Wales. Sian, Hugh, welcome to History Hack.
Thank you very much.
So I will start straight in with the first question. Considering your accents, it's probably an easy question for you. What inspired you to write about this subject?
I actually relocated to Ireland 22 years ago now, and I was 38 at the time and settled at that stage of my life. So it was like starting all over again, a sort of a real culture shock. So I decided to get to know more about Ireland, culture and history. And through discussions with my friends and work colleagues, in which I was sort of trying to find out about Ireland, they would often ask me about Wales. And I realized that I didn't have as deep a knowledge as I thought I had. So it also made me realize that the people outside of Wales maybe don't have a full understanding about who we are, and but we're keen to learn. So to improve that knowledge, I began to do some research. And it was like opening a door to a passionate then about Wales and its history, and I was really proud of how we had managed to retain our identity and not become a western region of England, really. I decided to post the information on a Facebook page, which is called The History of Wales, with information related to each day. And initially, the volume of information, it was like producing a newspaper. And so my sister, Sian, then offered to help me with the workload.
The page proved to be very, very popular and obviously struck a chord with people who were interested in Wales. The page now has more than 180,000 followers, mainly from Wales, but also from the wider diaspora, not just in the UK, but in the United States, Australia, New Zealand, all over the world, in fact, from United States to Pakistan. So it has proved to be very successful. Mm-hmm. And last year, a publisher from the University of Wales Press got in touch with us. They approached us and asked whether we were interested in turning the social media page into a book. They suggested the title Wales on This Day. And so every day there's subject matter which can vary, very eclectic mix. It could be something sports related, it could be historical, it could be a cultural event. For example, the first words ever spoken on Coronation Street were by a Welsh actor. And of course, there are other cultural and historical events as well.
Okay. This is brilliant. So what our plan for this episode is to just chuck stuff at you and you can tell us all about the awesomeness of Wales, which we're really excited about. This is one Chris has put on the list, and it's such a Chris thing to put on the list. What is a Paget leg?
Right. OK, well, basically, a Paget leg is an articulated wooden leg with movable joints at the knee, ankle and toe. It's also known as the Anglesey leg and was named after Henry William Paget, the first Marquess of Anglesey, who lived at Plas Newydd on Menai Strait, and he was the first person to use one. The background of the story, when war broke out with Napoleon's France, Paget raised a regiment of volunteers and began a military career that saw him rise to the rank of Major General. During the Battle of Waterloo, Paget was assigned as the Duke of Wellington's second in command, and led the charge of the heavy cavalry against the centre of the French line. He apparently had 8 horses shot from under him, each time calling for another and carrying on fighting. However, one of the last shots fired, Paget's right leg was hit, necessitating his amputation above the knee. 5 days after the battle, Paget was created Marquess of Anglesey by the Duke of Wellington and appointed a Knight of the Garter. The artificial leg, however, didn't impede his further career. He went on to lead a distinguished public life, twice becoming Lieutenant of Ireland. Now, there's some quite sort of amusing anecdotes about his stoicism in this incident. According to one, he exclaimed to Wellington after he'd been hit, "By God, sir, I've lost my leg." To which Wellington replied, "By God, sir, so you have." And accordingly, another comment was, at the time of the amputation, when he remarked to the surgeon that the knives appear somewhat blunt. He was quite a character. And the amputated leg later became a tourist attraction in Waterloo. And in 1816, the following year, a column was unveiled in Llanfair Pwllgwyngyll on Anglesey, commemorating his heroism.
So, because this is doing absolutely nothing with story number one for my notion that all Welsh people are a little bit insane.
Yeah.
I also, as well, I want to know how you, like, by the time you get down to horse number 6 and horse number 7, do you think the horses are all just lined up thinking, "I'm not going? No, I'm not going either. No way." Yeah. I saw what happened to the last 5. I'm staying here.
Yeah. Very good point.
So in your books, you do mention that this is something I like, as Alex knows. You mentioned how there's quite a lot of Welsh influence in the works of Tolkien, Lord of the Rings and so on, and how quite hilariously I think that Elvish gets mistaken for Welsh. Now, having grown up going from where I live in the Midlands, going on repeated family holidays to North Wales, where Welsh is by far the common tongue as opposed to English, and hearing that Elvish is mistaken for Welsh, I find that quite funny, but actually quite plausible too.
Yeah, the connection with the Midlands is quite interesting, because Tolkien himself lived in Birmingham as a child. He had quite a sad family history, really. He was born in South Africa, but his father tragically died very young of complications with rheumatic fever. So his mother, Mabel, took Tolkien and his younger brother to Birmingham, where they lived in not a particularly salubrious area of the city, very close to a railway station. And Tolkien's first contact with Welsh was on the coal trucks that would have been brought from North Wales and would have Welsh writing on them. And he actually said himself that the names, the language written on the trucks, brought, as he puts it, a flash of strange spelling and a hint of a language old and yet alive. It pierced my linguistic heart. So yes, Tolkien's work is heavily influenced by Wales and especially the Welsh language. And many people have commented, just as you said, that the Elvish language, Sindarin, sounds very much like Welsh. And it appears that Tolkien not necessarily copied the words of Welsh, but the sounds, the lyricism and the musicality of the language, which many people say that Welsh is very musical, that does feature in Sindarin. He was also very fond of the Welsh landscape, and at a time when industrialization was transforming the British countryside, he had quite a fondness for certain parts of Wales, particularly the area surrounding the Brecon Beacons, the Shire, for example, in The Hobbit and in Lord of the Rings, was possibly inspired by the landscape around Crickhowell and Brecon. Crickhowell itself more or less equates to Crickhowell. It sounds similar, Crick Hollow, Crick Howell. They do have a very similar sound. And he actually claimed that The Lord of the Rings was his own interpretation of the mythical Red Book of Westmarch, which was based on the real-life Red Book of Hergest, one of the oldest and most important Welsh manuscripts of the Middle Ages. So he went on to study Welsh in university and possessed some very heavily personally annotated copies of the Mabinogion, for example, which is a collection of Celtic myths and Arthurian legends from medieval Wales. So yes, his fondness, his love, his enthusiasm for the Welsh language manifests itself in many different ways in his work. And Dr. Carl Phelpsnett of Cardiff University actually said that for many of us, the language rings a bell, or rather stirs deep harp strings in our linguistic nature. It's the native language to which, in unexplained desire, we would still go home. Tolkien said, Welsh is of this soil, this island, the senior language of the men of Britain. Welsh is beautiful. And I agree.
Indeed. Let's go for something slightly less highbrow, like, though. Chris is adamant, being a boaty historian, that we can't not ask you about the entry for International Talk Like a Pirate Day. Wales has quite a connection to it, doesn't it? And even a patron saint.
But before we, I suppose if there's any children listening, and before we start glorifying piracy, we should throw in the caveat that these weren't men acting for the greater good. They were in large, vicious, selfish, ruthless opportunists. So we'll put that in. But that being said, it's still a good story. So the 19th of September is International Talk Like a Pirate Day. And it gives us the opportunity to look at some of the historical Welsh connections to piracy. For example, St. Patrick arguably is Welsh and was kidnapped by pirates before being taken to Ireland and sold into slavery. Gwynllw, king of Gwynllwyg, a medieval kingdom in East Wales, led a life of violence and piracy, reportedly, and caused terror across the Bristol Channel. However, later in life, he gave up his life of terror and converted to Christianity, becoming the patron saint of Welsh pirates. So, the classic era of piracy, and the one that's most often referred to, is that which occurred in the Caribbean from around 1650 to the 1720s. This was when England, France, and the Dutch began to develop their competing empires, and consequently there was a considerable amount of seaborne trade, with many ships travelling with valuable cargoes being the targets for pirate attack. attacks. So notable pirates from this era would be Henry Morgan, who the famous rum is named after. He was a farmer's son from a place called Llanrumney. And Black Bart, who was born John Roberts in Little Newcastle near Fishguard. Henry Morgan fought for the English against the Spanish in the Caribbean, and helped establish Jamaica as a, as an English colony. He was knighted by King Charles II and died a very rich man in Jamaica in 1688. And a sort of an interesting point there that at his funeral, an amnesty was declared that allowed fellow pirates to pay their respects without fear or arrest. So that's quite an interesting point. The Black Bart was one of the most successful pirates of the Golden Age, reportedly responsible for the capture of over 400 ships, and the equivalent of over £50 million of loot. His success was due in large part to his organization. He was responsible for introducing the Pirates Code, which gave every crew member a vote, encouraged prayer. He also drank a lot of tea, apparently, and was opposed to alcohol, and forbade gambling amongst the crew. Anyway, so towards the mid-18th century, the improved efficiency of the country's navies and the authorities resulted in piracy being made far more difficult. And there were far less safe bases from which the pirates could operate. So this spelt an end to the golden age of piracy, but also saw an increase in smuggling, with the isolated beaches of North Wales and the Bristol Channel being particularly popular landing sites for the illicit goods. And one example is the Scottish-born John Paul Jones, who is often referred to as the father of the American Navy. He was active in the waters around Tenby, and has a beach named after him on Caldy Island. So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I was just thinking about the piracy. I'm sure, as I said, I grew up on holidays in North Wales, and I'm certain the last time, I'm sure there's like in Barmouth, there's like a monument about smugglers and pirates. And it's been years since I went and looked at it, so I'd have to go and look at it again. But I'm certain it talks about smugglers, because there's just, as I said, there's nothing, they're so isolated, there's nothing there.
No, that's right. You know, it's a remote area, or was particularly in that time, and the estuary, the river, the Mowthach would have been a very good area for the pirates to sail from.
Yeah, absolutely. The next question, I'm going to throw a particular date at you, and you can tell us all about this date. I'm quite intrigued by this date myself. I haven't gone and looked up at this, so I'm looking forward to the surprise. What happened on the 10th of September, 1814?
Well, it's not a particularly salubrious story, I'm afraid, but quite an interesting one. That date, the 10th of September, the last recorded fatal pistol duel in Wales took place near Newcastle Emlyn. It's a story of jealousy, rivalry, lust, and violence.
Outstanding.
Excellent.
The story goes that a chap called Thomas Heslop, who was a native of West Indian, he was of West Indian origin and only recently arrived to Wales, was invited on a partridge shoot by a solicitor from Newcastle Emlyn, and things didn't go too well. Heslop was very unhappy with the way the day had panned out. He was disappointed with the shoot. He described it as a bad day's sport, simply because he hadn't been allowed to shoot where he wanted to shoot at random in the Welsh countryside. So he was unhappy. His friend, John Bynan, thought that he might try and diffuse this sort of situation which was developing in a public place. It was, in fact, in the old Salutation Inn overlooking the River Tyvee in Newcastle Emlyn. And to try and diffuse the situation, he made a few derogatory remarks about the barmaid. Now, we don't know exactly what he said. That has to be left to the imagination.
I was a barmaid for 11 years, I can imagine.
So, yeah, you can just imagine the sort of thing that might have been said. However, this inflamed Heslop because he fancied the barmaid and wanted to defend her honour. He objected to the coarse language that Bynan had used, and he called Bynan a damned villain and a scoundrel, and challenged him to a duel, which Bynan accepted. And 2 days later, on Saturday, the 10th of September, 1814, they met in a field outside Newcastle Emlyn called Danwarthin Fields, through which ran a stream. Now, the two men stood one on either side of the stream with their backs to each other and were to walk the 10 statutory paces forward before turning and firing their pistols. But Bynan, who probably was a damned villain and a scoundrel, only walked 5 paces before turning and shooting Heslop in the back. He was pronounced dead at the scene by a surgeon who was there, John Williams, and Bynan was prosecuted alongside the two seconds who had been there, appeared in Cardigan Crown Court, accused of shooting Thomas Heslop with a leaden bullet discharged from a pistol. They were found guilty, but because Bynan was big pals with a local JP and friends with a lot of solicitors, he was a solicitor himself, he got the charge reduced to a fine. Now, that caused utter outrage locally, and they went looking for him. He was forced to hide in a cellar before escaping to America. The locals clubbed together. They gave Heslop, Thomas Heslop, a decent burial, and you will find a gravestone engraved with "Alas, poor Heslop" on it in Newcastle Emlyn, in the church of Llandyfriog nearby. So there we have it. Violence, violent death, lust, bloodshed, and a bit of scandal.
The Welsh are exciting. Right, let's move fully into Beth and I's wheelhouse and the First World War. Why do the Welsh have a claim for saying that they carried out the first action of the First World War?
Yes. The First World War broke out on the 4th of August 1914 in Britain, between Britain and Germany, and within a minute of the outbreak, Newport police captured a German freighter called the Belgia, which was anchored in the Bristol Channel. The previous day, Germany had declared war on France, and the captain of the Belgia, fearing that he might be attacked by the French, had headed what he thought would be the safe waters off South Wales. This incident, during which 20 crew and 75 naval reservists were taken prisoner, is therefore considered by many to be the first British action of the war against Germany. There's an interesting story to it as well. As part of the cargo, the Belgia was carrying animals due for Hamburg Zoo, which included alligators, chameleons, raccoons, and rattlesnakes. And these mysteriously appeared in a market at Abergavenny a few days later. So that's what happened there. The Belgia herself was commandeered by the Merchant Navy and was renamed Hunstrike. Eventually, and remained in service until she herself was sunk by a German U-boat off Morocco in 1917.
Love the thought of in Abergavenny. Right, we're going to have these raccoons now. We're going to have these.
I'd say it would have been an unusual items for sale in Abergavenny market that week.
Certainly would, yeah.
Absolutely, definitely. Again, moving again slightly even more forward, we've got lots of very interesting stories to talk about, but we're going to pull it forward a little bit even more to the modern day. I'm very, very intrigued by this. How does a milkman from Wales link to the moon landings?
Well, as we all know, 20th of July 1969 saw Neil Armstrong becoming the first human to walk on the surface of the moon. But what many people don't know is that watching avidly from Earth was a man called George Abbey, who was the assistant director of the Johnson Space Center, and whose mother was from Larne in Carmarthenshire, which is incidentally where we're speaking to you from today, looking out at the castle and the estuary of the River Tarv. Now, Larne is famous for many things. It's a small township with a corporation, only one of two towns in the UK that have their original corporation. But anyway, George Abbey's mother was a Larney. She lived in the Smith's Arms in Larne and went to work in London, where she met Samuel Abbey, who was George Abbey's father. George, like all of us who know Larne, loved the place so much that they have to come back and back and back. And he spent several happy childhood holidays in Larne, where he got very friendly with his mother's cousin, Dick Lewis, who was known as Dick the Farm or Dick the Milk, because he was the local milkman. Now, my mother, when she was in her teens, worked with Dick the Milk on the back of his truck, pouring out milk into people's jugs as they travelled around Larne. So there we are. There's a lovely family connection for us with this story too. During the time that Dylan Thomas was living in Larne, now we all know Dylan Thomas is the famous Welsh poet who lived in the boathouse in Larne, which I can actually see through our living room window. He became very friendly with Dick the Milk. They had an affinity. Dick the Milk was quite an astute and quite a learned man. He was self-taught, never went to university, but he and Dylan Thomas used to spend a lot of time together. In fact, they drank together every afternoon in the Brown's Hotel in Larne. And Dick the Milk was one of the pallbearers at Dylan's funeral. Now, George Abbey, coming back to the moon landing, George Abbey was very keen on his Welsh roots. He said, there was a very strong Welsh feeling in our home because my mother spoke Welsh. And on one visit to Larne, he visited the boathouse, which has now been turned into a little museum of the life of Dylan Thomas. He asked them whether he could take something from the boathouse into space so that it could be verified and it would prove a bit of a tourist attraction. And so he did. The photograph of Dylan Thomas went up in space and is now still in the boathouse in Larne for visitors to see. So there we are. He also he tried to ensure that there was a Welsh angle to many of the space flights that he was connected with. And he told his staff that if the weather was good, I'd try to get the astronauts to get a picture of Wales because of my Welsh roots. Not often possible because there's so much Wales, but yeah, that was the connection between the moon landings and the milkman from Larne.
Absolutely baffling. That's taken my breath away. I like that one. Right, I'm gonna keep giggling if I'm not careful. So now, right, let's revert to serious face and revert to serious story. Obviously, there's some fantastic stories, and this book sounds like it's going to be amazing to read. But there are obviously the gruesome elements. There's the bits that aren't so nice. Can you please tell us the story of Quartermaster Hence Thomas Lewis?
Yes. Quartermaster Hence Thomas Lewis was from Moylvre on Anglesey, and his claim to fame is that he was one of three survivors of the 470 people on board a maritime disaster, which is considered to be one of the worst in New Zealand's history. In November 1874, the emigration ship Cospatrick was sailing from England to Auckland in New Zealand. The passengers were mainly agricultural workers and their families looking to make a fresh start in the their new colony of New Zealand. When they reached the Cape of Good Hope, a fire broke out on board, thought to have been caused by a passenger carrying a candle in the cargo area of the ship that had accidentally set fire to some tar used for the ship's maintenance. The fire spread quickly and the ship was quickly destroyed. In the resulting panic, only two of the lifeboats were able to be launched. So the remainder of the passengers were lost with the ship. A storm then moved in and the lifeboats got separated. One sank with no survivors, and most of the occupants of the other lifeboat died due to exposure to the elements and lack of food. The gruesome bit then is that the last of the survivors reputedly then drank the blood and ate the livers of the dead people. Mm. After 7 days adrift, only five were still alive when they were rescued by a passing ship. And unfortunately, two more died shortly afterwards. Ultimately, then, the surviving three men were later put on trial for cannibalism. However, there's no reports that they were convicted, as Lewis returned to his native Anglesey to live and lived there for a further 20 years. So that's the story of Quartermaster Hence Thomas Lewis.
That sounds like a very low budget Netflix film where they could get away with just one boat in some water and about three cast members. Let's go big scale though. Tell us about the effect that Wales has on the Roman Emperor Maximus.
Ah, the Romans. What do the Romans ever do for us? as we know, the Romans were hugely influential in Wales, and you travel the length and breadth of the country and you're never going to be far from a Roman fort or Roman gold, silver, copper, or tin mine. They're everywhere. We've all seen pictures of the magnificent Roman amphitheatre in Caerleon, for example. There were huge forts in Cardiff, in Brecon, and of course in North Wales, in Carnarvon. They also built a few roads. But towards the end of the Roman rule, when the structure of the Roman Empire started breaking down, we're talking now about the late 4th century, things started to go a little bit pear-shaped. And during that time, Magnus Maximus was assigned to Carnarvon, firstly as a general in the Roman army in the year 380. He settled there and he even got a Welsh name. In Wales, he's known as Maxen Wledig. He settled and he married the daughter, of the Romano-British ruler, Octavius. Her name was Ellen. And Ellen encouraged Maximus in his enterprises, and she encouraged him particularly to build roads in order that the country be more easily defended. Now, one of the most popular walking routes in Wales is along the Roman route of Sarn Helen, which was named after Ellen. It runs from Carnarvon in the north to South Wales. More recently, Maxen Wledig, Maximus, has become something of a folk hero, based on the largely fictionalised account in the Mabinogion, which I mentioned earlier. That was the book of medieval Welsh legends. And in it is a section called Maxen's Dream, Braidhwyd Maxen Wledig. And in the dream, he dreams of becoming Emperor of Rome. He's portrayed as a bit of a national hero in the song by Dafydd Iwan, who's a renowned Welsh folk singer. The song is called Yma o Hyd, and you may well hear it on a regular basis fairly soon, because the song has been adapted as the anthem of the Welsh football team, who are embarking on their, I'm sure, successful attempt at winning the World Cup. We'll see about that one. But in truth, Maxen was actually chosen by his men as Emperor of Britain and Gaul. And in 383, he overreached himself slightly because he declared himself as Western Emperor. For a time, he was recognised as such by Theodosius, who was the Eastern Emperor. But ultimately, in war and politics, they fell out. They clashed in their bid for imperial power. And Theodosius campaigned against Maximus and defeated him in the Battle of Save in modern-day Croatia. Maximus pleaded for his life, but was executed on the 28th of August 388. Now, his legacy is in his descendants. The marriage of Maximus and Ellen resulted in a string of British descendants. Their daughter, Severia, is commemorated on the Pillar of Eliseg, an early medieval inscribed stone near Llangollen in the Vale of Dee, which says on the pillar that she was married to Vortigern, king of the Britons. Now, this would have made Maximus the founding father of several royal dynasties in Wales, including those of Powys and Gwent. And those kings would later use the authority of Magnus Maximus of Maxen Wledig as the basis of their inherited political legitimacy. So there we have Maxen Wledig,
Welsh Emperor of Rome.
I didn't even know that at all. That's such an interesting connection there. But as you say quite rightly, the Romans, they just get everywhere, don't they? Speaking of then invaders, obviously the Roman invasion of Britain went fairly well, all things considered. But generally, invasions of Wales itself don't go very, very well. Fishguard is obviously a very well-known example of that. But there's other invasions, isn't there? And there's particularly one that's from the there was a Flemish invasion, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. Probably not that well known. On the 2nd of January 1155, Munt Bay, which is a few miles north of Cardigan, was the site of an unsuccessful Flemish invasion of the kingdom of De Heibarth in West Wales. The Flemish soldiers that landed were heavily defeated by the native Welsh, and the victory was celebrated in later centuries by a festival known as Sul Coch y Mwynt, or Red Sunday, a reference to the bloodshed during the invasion. The background to the invasion is interesting, and the Flemish were of how they appeared in Wales. William the Conqueror's wife, Matilda, was the daughter of Baldwin V, Count of Flanders, and many Flemish fought for William during the Norman invasion of England in 1066, and was subsequently rewarded with landholdings. So by the 12th century, the early 12th century, Flanders was becoming overpopulated, and combined with a devastating flood in 1106, more Flemish people wanted to move to England. So initially they were welcomed, but due to the numbers, friction soon developed between them and the English. So the then king of England, Henry I, solution was to drive out the native Welsh of parts of West Wales and to colonise the Flemish people there. Henry died in 1135, and the following succession crisis, which the anarchy, resulted in a civil war that lasted until 1153, when his grandson Henry II took the throne. So, unsurprisingly, Welsh rulers took advantage of the anarchy to regain disputed lands that they had lost during the Norman invasion of Wales. But Henry II set about trying to reverse this trend, and the invasion in Munt was probably part of this process. There's an interesting connection as well in Pembrokeshire with the Flemish people as well. There's a border between South and North Pembrokeshire, which to this day is referred to as the Lanska Line, where the southern area remained under the control of the Normans and the Flemish, and the native Welsh were occupied the northern area. Haverford West Castle, for example, was built by a Flemish leader called Tancred, and Wizen Castle nearby by the wonderfully named Wizzo. There was also a Letard, Litelking, built a castle in nearby Letterston. The Flemish were also skilled woolen traders, and Tenby in southern Pembrokeshire flourished as a trading centre subsequently. Thing that happened with the Flemish influence was that the Welsh language was eradicated in this area and replaced with a Flemish dialect of English, and there are still traces of that that can be identified today, such as the word budger is used for butcher, catchy pole for tadpole, and frost candles for icicles. And this has led to the area being referred to as Little England beyond Wales.
I love that. I am only ever going to refer to icicles as frost. That's just
frost candles. Yeah,
that's just fantastic.
just playing into her whole "I'm a Disney princess Frozen" vibe that she's got going on in her head at this point. Should we try and let's smash out a couple more before we run out of time? Okay, so back in my wheelhouse, Titanic, right? So there are three Welsh connections to Titanic. Now, one of them's going to be Harold Low, isn't it, in the north of Wales? But what else have you got for us?
Oh, Harold Low, of course, yes, from Llanrwst in Carnarvonshire, was the fifth officer on the Titanic. But he was the only one who rowed back to save drowning passengers.
God, I don't know how far you've listened to History Hack, but we have had Ioan Griffith on the show, and I'm pretty sure it made it into the episode because we made him do the "Is there anyone alive out there?" bit, so because we had to hear it.
Yeah, no, but that isn't the main connection. When the Titanic sank in the North Atlantic on the 15th of April in 1912, there was somebody 3,000 miles away listening on his homemade radio. And this chap was Artie Moore, who was an amateur wireless operator from Blackwood, which is a small town in the South Wales valleys. And he was probably the first person to hear the distress signals from the Titanic. Now, he ran straight away to the local police force to try and relay the news and to alert the authorities. But nobody believed him. They refused to believe in 1912 that it was possible to pick up a message in the air. And it was 2 days before the news finally officially broke. There are a couple of other connections. There was a boxer, two boxers from Wales, actually, on the Titanic. He was Welsh lightweight champion from Treherbert. His name was David John Bowen. And he was travelling to the United States for a series of boxing contests with his fellow boxer, Leslie Williams, from Tonopandy. And 2 days prior to the sinking of the Titanic, he had written a letter to his mother saying that this is a lovely boat. She is very near so big as Treherbert. So that's rather a nice one. Not many people know either that the cutlery, the silverware on the Titanic, was Elkington silverware from Burryport in South Wales. And finally, everyone in Wales knows about Wrexham Lager. And Wrexham Lager was the main beer that was served in the bar on the Titanic. There we are.
Outstanding.
Wonderful. Oh, just to bring things, because I think I could listen to stories about the stories for this book for hours and hours and hours. They're just so fascinating. But to bring it all to a sort of nice, tidy conclusion, there's so many great historical personalities that I'm sure are mentioned in this book and that we haven't managed to talk about today. And people that we don't know about and that we should. And one of those is mentioned in your book, and this is William Herbert Baron of Cardiff. Who is William, please?
the story of William Herbert emphasises the subjugation of Wales in the 13th century by Edward I and subsequently the Act of Union of Henry VIII in 1536, where individuals loyal to the crown were rewarded with land in Wales. William Herbert's family, for example, had come to prominence at the Battle of Agincourt and during the Wars of the Roses. In his youth, William was described as a mad fighting fellow, and was forced to flee to France after he had killed a man in a fight in Bristol. In France, he joined the service of King Francis I and earned the reputation of being a brave and courageous soldier. So much so that when he decided to return to Britain, Francis recommended him for a senior role in Henry VIII's court. And he subsequently became a highly influential figure in the Tudor royal court. He met and married Anne Parr, who was the sister of Henry's sixth wife, Catherine Parr. And when Henry died in 1547, William Herbert acted as the executor to his will and was a guardian of the young King Edward VI. He was created Baron Herbert in reward on 10th of October 1551, which also gave him Caerphilly Castle, control of Caerphilly Castle and extensive lands in South Wales. Following Edward's the sixth death, Herbert became involved in the plan to place the Protestant Lady Jane Grey on the throne, but was wise enough that when it became clear that Lady Mary Tudor would take the throne, he wisely switched his allegiance. And acted as an escort for Mary's future husband, King Philip of Spain, on his journey to London. Herbert's good relations then continued with a close friendship with Queen Elizabeth I. Interestingly then as well, Cardiff Castle and estate passed through the Herbert family, but through marriage, landed with the Marquis of Bute, who is well known in the Cardiff area. He was instrumental in the development of Cardiff as a port when the Welsh coal industry boomed in the 19th century, which made the Marquis of Bute family extremely wealthy. And they were able to rebuild Cardiff Castle in the grand sort of style that you see today. However, following World War One, where the coal industry went into decline, and followed by the Depression of the 1930s, in 1947, the fifth Marquess inherited the castle, but facing considerable death duties, he sold the remainder of the lands in Cardiff and gave the castle to the people of Cardiff.
Oh, what a way to end. Guys, thank you so much. This has been absolutely brilliant. This has been an hour of fun-filled and stuff I didn't know as well. If you'd have asked me, like, what is there about Wales? I'd be like, there's some Tudor stuff and some fighty people and some King Arthur, and that's about it. And absolutely, it's clearly not. People can join you on your Facebook page, which is the History of Wales as well. And we will, of course, put your book in our new online bookstore. But guys, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your stories with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for hosting us.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.